Brittany, when she read your poem, she read it and then she'd look up and look around the room at all the ancestors that I have hanging around here. Somebody asked me once, how come I tacked things up on the wall? And the only answer I could give was, well, you know, I like looking at them. But also, they all mean something to me. Yeah.
So I wrote a poem in response to that, and that's the poem that you've referenced. It said that Jack Spicer wrote the last letter of his life to you. Have you heard that?
Really?
The last known letter that he ever sent was to you.
Oh, my God.
That's my understanding.
Did he keep a copy?
I don't know. I think Amel Al-Khaled would be the person to ask about that. I forget where I read that. It might have been...
My God, you know, there are three very important people in my life from whom I've received letters, and I don't have a single one of them. The letter from Lou Welch disappeared, the letter from Thomas Merton disappeared, and now the letter from Jack Spicer disappeared.
You studied with Lou Welch.
Yes.
Tell us about how you met him. Did you meet him at Berkeley, obviously?
Met him at the poetry conference, and then he took over Gary Snyder's Cal Extension class in San Francisco, and I signed up for it, and I was allowed to go. He asked me in to read at one of the classes, and Mother Superior went with me. I remember that. And another time, Mother Superior took me to a meeting, I don't know, somewhere in San Francisco, to avoid my going out to a peace rally, which I wasn't supposed to do. And I think that issue, the wrangle that I had with the Mother Superior over my working with the peace community to end the war, she was horrified. I stood on a street corner and passed out pamphlets. And she was horrified. What would the bishop say? The whole thing, and that was when I realized that appearances were more important than convictions, or appearances were indications of inner convictions. I'm not sure exactly how to put it, but that's when I realized that I was living and working and praying with women with whom I had nothing in common. And it was hypocrisy. It was terrible hypocrisy.
The March on Washington was the other historic event that I alluded to in my introduction. The March on Washington had an effect on you. Watching it on TV, were you able to see on TV?
Yes. I watched it on TV. And it wasn't just the kind of presence that Martin Luther King had, but it was also the songs that were sung that day. And Peter, Paul, and Mary sang If I Had a Hammer, and I was enthralled by that. I love music. I love singing. And you know how when you watch an adolescent kid sing along with a record and they're singing the words and they're not paying any attention to what they're singing? Well, I had done that for years. And then after hearing If I Had a Hammer, I began to pay attention to what the songs were saying. And I began to hear about Bob Dylan and what he had to say, and I was blown away, realizing that there was another world out there than the one of white privilege in which I dwelt.
What did you learn from Lew Welch?
To be simple, to be straightforward, to tell the truth. And what he said in that letter to me, which I pretty much remember, he said that the call of poetry was as great as any priesthood in any religious persuasion could ever imagine to be. And he answered the calling. He did.
Did you ever have any sense he could be the kind of guy who would walk into the woods and never come back?
Lou drank, and at the time, no, I did not have a sense. Now I understand. Lou didn't have the escape hatch that I think it was William Styron. I believe. It was a novelist, very famous, and I think it was William Styron, who had trouble with drinking, I believe. And he hit bottom. And so he was going to end it all. And he wrote a suicide note. And being a writer, of course, he looked it over. And he said, I can't leave the world with this crap. I think that's one of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard. So he checked himself into the hospital and got well.
And Lou checked himself into the woods and just didn't come back.
And didn't come back, yeah. And up there, there are little caves and hidey holes in those mountains that, you know, of course they never found him. He didn't want to be found. Being around someone who drinks himself to death is very, very hard on the people who are around him or her. And dealing with that disease is, I don't know. I can't find the words.
One of your other teachers was William Everson, Brother Antoninus. Did you meet him when he was Brother Antoninus?
Yes. Yes. I used to visit him, and we would sit in the kitchen at the priory in this little breakfast booth and talk poetry and talk poetry and talk poetry and talk shop. I love writers who can talk shop nicely. Bob Dylan is one. Surprisingly, Jack Nicholson is another. Both of whom I think are prime examples that great artists are not necessarily nice people. So, anyway, I think I'm kind of off the tack now. Where were we?
Well, we were on Brother Antoninus. And.
Oh, yeah. And and then I saw him fairly frequently. He was teaching at UC Santa Cruz, and I lived down there for a couple of years. And I went to his class. And I liked it. I liked his class. I think he was concerned with the position of the poet in the world. just as Lou was, just as we all are. I maintain that poets are the soul of any nation. But maybe that's only how we poets regard ourselves. I don't know.
Going back to the convent, near the end there, you were taking food out of the pantry to feed the diggers and Diane de Prima and people associated with that. Tell us about that. So a lot of salami? What would you take to them?
Turkey.
Did they have requests? Hey, get us some potatoes. Can you bring some crackers? I mean, what was it?
Well, I met Diane when the diggers gave big Thanksgiving dinner. And every year, the girls in the school where I taught would solicit Thanksgiving baskets. And they had about 5 or 6 turkeys left over. We had the convent turkey. So I said, come on, let's give them to the diggers. And that's when I found out that there were 2 types of poor to which we paid attention. One was the deserving poor, and the other was, what, the hippies, the rest, whatever. And we were to pay attention only to the deserving poor, whatever that meant. So, of course, you know, I was looked on with... I felt... I liked that whole episode because I felt a lot like St. Bridget. St. Bridget gave everything away. And when she finished giving away all her possessions, she gave away her father's possessions and her mother's possessions and all her siblings' possessions and the castle and the crops. Everything. She gave it away. She's a great saint. She was also a goddess in the Gaelic tradition, as was Maeve, a goddess in the Gaelic tradition.
I'm reminded of a poem that you have that references the saints, and I think it references St. Bridget.
Oh, Hibernian Voodoo?
Is that the one? I don't have a table of contents here, so it's...
Yeah, I know. I should have done that for you. Well, I understand you can get the computer to do that, but I have no idea how.
Here it is. Yeah.
Hibernian Voodoo. Efficacious when practiced properly, that is, when correct saints are invoked. Saint Bridget for giving, Saint Earth for standing, Saint Neot for taking away. All that grace hiding under miner's lettuce and clover leaf, the woods peopled with ancient friends, enemies, and Coyote's Irish clone. They come out at night, preferring the moon. Sun makes them wispy and weak, but not so weak as to weaken their power, their poise, their eternal, boundless knack for wringing our necks with promises and double entendre. Years of bloodlust, oppression by reavers and Cromwellian grotesques have never and never will suppress the look in leprechauns' eyes. And when lightning strikes on top of the house, look out. See them all of them, dancing in the liquid light.
There's a postscript to that poem.
Yes. Probably Liquid Light is Jameson's or Bushmills.